Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Everything is Black and White podcast. It's time for the latest episode of In Conversation with Lee Ryder, Chief Newcastle United writer here at Chronicle Live. I'm your host, Andrew Musgrove, and this week's topic is all about the managers that Lee has dealt with in his time covering Newcastle United. And ladies and gents, it is a long list. You'll need no reminding, Lee's been here since 2005, and we've just gone through the list of managers. And not only is it a long list, it is a list of some absolute characters, shall we say. Some talented managers, some not so, but characters nonetheless. Lee, I think what I'll do is I'll read the list off first, and then we'll dive in to a few questions about these chaps. So we've got Souness, Glenn Roeder, Sam Allardyce, then Kevin Keegan, then Alan Shearer, then Joe Kinnear, then Chris Hughton, Alan Pardew, John Carver, Steve McLaren. I think that was the other way around, but then Rafa Benitez, Steve Bruce, and now Eddie Howe. As I said, I mean, first off, that's just a long list of characters and different personalities, first and foremost.
Yeah, I mean, it's a reflection of where the football club was, certainly during my early time covering the club and, you know, the turbulence of the Mike Ashley era, really. I mean, Freddie Shepherd was chairman when I first started, but the Mike Ashley era, we all know what it's a disaster, really, wasn't it? The way business was conducted and the fact that, you know, managers just weren't putting up with it. And those who did, you know, weren't going to be elite managers, if you like. It's a long list, but it's reflective of that period of time in the club's history.
And when you have such a long list of managers and so much change, for you as a journalist, someone who's got to sit and talk to these chaps, not just once a week, but maybe twice, thrice a week, how easy or difficult is it to kind of get to know their personalities? And because they'll all tick in different ways. They'll all find something a little bit more annoying than something else. And that doesn't, working that out and building up that relationship to get to that conclusion doesn't just happen overnight, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, as I touched on in previous podcasts, different managers will afford you different amounts of time. But even if you're not afforded extra time over the course of a season, then you're going to get to know the manager just by sitting in each press conference and how much your rapport levels are going to build up with that man in the hot seat. And that's basically how I've always looked at it. Generally, I think the managers that will take time, and Eddie Howe has done this as well in pre-seasons and mid-season training camps. Eddie has taken time also, but it's that amount of time a manager gives himself to build up an understanding with journalists as well. And, you know, it can go two ways, because obviously there's been some stormy episodes with managers down the years, as we all know.
Yeah, indeed. And I guess when you look around in today's game, there's certain managers that I look at in press conferences and just think, you really cannot be bothered to talk to the press here. Some of their answers are like one words or what, or one liners, and they're very quick and there's not much personality going on. I think, like, I look at Ange at Tottenham Hotspur, he doesn't look like he wants to be in the room. You know, I don't know. That's just my opinion. I'm just wondering, out of this list, were any like that where you kind of got a feeling that they didn't really, I don't know if respect, not respect's the right term, but, you know, they didn't really want to answer questions. They didn't really, they were doing the press conference out of a sense of duty rather than a sense of want.
I mean, of all the managers that I've sort of covered, I've never, I think Steve Bruce had a time where he said, that's it, I'm not speaking to the local paper, away from the press conference. And there was a short period in the Steve Bruce era where I think he was only taking questions from TV reporters. And then that was it. I think it was after they lost 2-0 at Aston Villa or something like that. It was a game around that time where it was starting to become heavy on the manager, and he refused to speak at certain times. But before that, I think he did try his best to build up a rapport, but it fell to pieces for results reasons, really, because, you know, the fans weren't happy with the manager, and we've got to reflect that. I mean, Graeme Souness had his moments, but I think he tried early again to build a rapport, but by the end of it, he just kind of, you know, stormed off. Didn't want to deal with the press too much. And I think at one point I was left with his assistant was the only guy who would speak to me, Alan Murray. So yeah, there's been different incidents down the years. But we haven't really seen anything too controversial with Eddie Howe to this point.
Yeah, to this point. And I guess what you get with Howe, he understands that when things are going badly, that he's going to be asked difficult questions by the press. He accepts kind of the criticism. And I like to think he does that, because the way you improve in any walk of life is by accepting criticism, dealing with the tough questions. And that always helps to drive you on, and that's really important, isn't it? Because especially in a city like Newcastle, where the local press, not just us here, you know, there's other local media outlets, I think it's really important that the club understand just how valuable, you know, the local press is to not only getting the message they want out, but, like we say, holding them to account when things aren't going well or when mistakes have been made, and just really being that kind of connection between the club and the fans. And it seems like Eddie Howe understands that.
Yeah, I think he does. And I don't think at any point he's kind of dismissed the local press. He's done it a different way. And I think some of it's because of Premier League rules as well, where everything has to be done in this kind of enclosed environment, and it goes straight onto to YouTube. So I think it is modern times where, you know, the manager has to stick to the sort of Premier League rule book to an extent. You look at, as I say, the pre-seasons are the ones where you really get the chance to sit down with the manager. When we went over to Saudi Arabia as well, we were sat in the team hotel with Eddie Howe and spent a lot of time with them there. And you do see, there's more than, once the camera is not there, which I appreciate, the readers won't see all of that. That is when you kind of see the true manager, who sat there in front of you, and you see what type of a person they are. And I think Eddie Howe is very honest, and I think very intelligent, the way that he sort of conducts his business with the media. But I think there's also a kind of a level of respect between the journalists and Eddie Howe, given everything he's brought to the club in the last 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, that's very important, isn't it, in that relationship. One of the big instances, I guess many people will remember, and it was the 10-year anniversary of this happening last week, and it was when Alan Pardew accused the Sunday Sun, which is obviously the Chronicle's paper on a Sunday, of being the reason for poor form. And we did a back page, didn't we, where we apologised in a rather sarcastic tone and enlisted all the things that we were responsible for. Again, in a sarcastic tone, there was the defeats to certain teams and the bad run of form. What do you remember of that time, Lee? Because that was quite bold, I guess, by the Sunday Sun to do that.
Yeah, and I think that was during a time where Alan Pardew just literally, we weren't allowed into the press conferences at home during that time. And just when he gets a great away win at Hull, and he should probably be sitting there, you know, enjoying that win. I think he headbutted David Mailer around that time. So just when, you know, he had that moment where he could have, like, you know, enjoyed it, he wasn't able to because of the nature of that incident, which ironically led to a ban for him as well. So we were banned from covering press conference. He was banned from the stadium altogether for, I think it was at least six or seven games, I believe. So yeah, it was an incredible time. But at that point, Alan Pardew had, you know, and obviously Mike Ashley had banned all the local papers, the Journal, Chronicle, and Sunday. So not just me. There was a band of us that were not allowed to go to the press conferences, go in the press box, and it kind of culminated in this strange sort of environment for us because we could still go to the away games, and they couldn't stop us from asking questions. And while they wouldn't answer the questions to begin with, we were all still asking them because that was the, you know, we were journalists, and, you know, we've been invited to that press conference by the home club. So we were entitled to ask the questions, and we still asked them. They didn't answer them at first, and then they realised that it was starting to become a little bit daft, and they started answering questions. And then eventually that ban, I think it's the longest ban I've ever known for the media. That ban was eventually lifted, and, you know, we were allowed back in. But the Alan Pardew incident was pretty crazy. And there was one press conference where he didn't turn up at all. They got beat 4-0 off Southampton. And he just thought, you know what, I'm not speaking to the local press, I'm not speaking to any of them, and just didn't turn up for the press conference. So incredible, which is a story in itself as well, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. I guess many people, they would be wondering, when you get that notification or that email or that phone call from the club to say, right, you guys aren't coming in, we're banning you, as it did happen under Mike Ashley, what's your first thought in that instance? Because, you know, it's happened before, it's happened, you know, it does happen at clubs every now and then, but it's not something that is a common occurrence. It's quite a big thing to ban the local press. So what was your initial reaction when that happened?
Yeah, well, when that happens, it's an ill wind. Nobody really benefits from it. If anyone benefits, it's probably the media, because they've got a story there and then. Because, you know, I think it made the front page of the Chronicle at the time. And for the managers, they then take away, well, they take away their oxygen, really, because then they don't have a platform anymore to talk. And it comes down to opinion, or, you know, there seems to be more supporter-led articles from supporters clubs and stuff like that seem to come up at that time. Thankfully, those times are gone. You know, I'm not wishing them any time to come back, because it's much more fun and enjoyable covering a winning team and covering a manager who has got the intelligence to know that he's using the local press to talk to the fans and the readers. He's not doing it to give me or anybody else a story. That is his platform to communicate with the supporters.
Yeah, and another manager I know you were very fond of, sadly no longer with us, was Glenn Rudd. I know you've got fond memories of Glenn. He came in as a temporary kind of stopgap, but it went so well. They had to change the rules to get him the job full-time because he didn't have his coaching badges or the right badges. Just talk to us about Glenn and why he, maybe above anyone else, stands out for you in terms of the relationship.
I mean, Glenn Rudd was a great human being, first and foremost. Such a, you know, lovely man. Great football manager as well, because he was so good at man management. understood Newcastle United, but understood giving younger players an opportunity. So we did see that side of Glenn at that point. And for me, what does stick out is that, you know, it was after, you know, Glenn Rhoda had been manager. And don't get us wrong here, by the way, because there were times where he would, you know, let you know in no uncertain terms that he wasn't happy with something. He would tell you, and he would tear a strip out of you, just like he would tear a strip out of one of his players. So, you know, it wasn't all 100% plain sailing, but at the end of it, you understood why he was frustrated, because he would give you, you know, a full analysis of why he was upset and what was upsetting him, sort of thing. But I think what I learned, I think after, you know, he left Newcastle, I used to bump into him, you know, on the football circuit at different grounds. He was doing scouting. He was doing various bits of work for other clubs as a consultant. And, you know, he stayed in touch. I kept his number, and he would ring you up and have a chat every now and again. And he would just give you like little bits of life advice, really. Not just talking about football, but how to deal with certain things in life. And I thought that was unbelievable, really, that, you know, you're still taking the time to keep that friendship, that relationship, whatever you want to call it, keep it going. And yeah, it was a very sad day when he passed away far too early. And yeah, you know, nothing but admiration for those times.
Yeah, Newcastle United legend, not only a fantastic manager, but a brilliant servant on the pitch for Newcastle as well during the 80s. And he is sorely missed. Another person who unfortunately died recently was Joe Kinnear. And when we talk about characters, Lee, he's a man who is probably the definition of a character. Won things at Wimbledon, came into Newcastle under Mike Ashley, then went on to become director of football as well for a wee bit. Just share your experiences of Joe Kinnear's Newcastle United manager.
Yeah, I mean, that was a crazy chapter in Newcastle's, you know, Premier League history, that Joe Kinnear had basically, you know, come in from the cold, had not been in management for a long time, and then suddenly, you know, he really was in charge of Newcastle. But, you know, once, I mean, obviously the famous incident is the press conference moment where, you know, he explodes with all the national reporters. We were actually outside the room, but yeah, obviously we could hear it because it was that loud and we couldn't believe what was going on. But and we were thinking at that point, you know, what's in store for us after that? But he was very, he was pro the local media. You know, he said, I think in one of his rants, that he would always work with the local press. And he was as good as his word, really. I mean, if I'm being honest, I think he didn't have a choice, really, did he? Because it was such a controversial appointment. He had to get somebody to give him a platform to talk, and he did so, but he did it very well. As I mentioned in a piece recently, that we were in his office quite a lot, and he would literally be showing us transfer shortlists. He'd literally be showing us, he had this sort of board on his wall with all the magnets of each player's name, and he'd always be, you know, moving them around and saying, oh, well, what team would you pick? And yes, he was buttering you up a little bit, but, you know, you actually seen the task he had with the players he had available. And yeah, look, had ill health not kicked in for him in 2009, then there's a good argument that he would have kept Newcastle in the Premier League, given where they were. And the fact that he had players on side, people like Kevin Nolan, Michael Owen was still at the club at the time. There was a lot of players still actually prepared to put in a shift for him. And we'll never know, but they were 13th in the table or something when he took ill with a few games to go. And then obviously things took a turn for the worse for Newcastle United on the whole.
Yeah, got relegated down to the Championship. We'll fly forward a couple of managers, Lee, to Rafa Benitez, because if we're talking about someone who really understands the importance of the local press and the media as a whole, it was Rafa Benitez. You know, he reportedly had a dossier on every local or every journalist that was at press conferences. That's how interested he was in you. And he would take you into his office, wouldn't he? And he would show you various things, a bit like Joe Kinnear about tactics and what have you. Just talk to us about Rafa Benitez.
Yeah, and that thing about the dossier is 100% true, because I've seen it, and each journalist had the picture on it, who they worked for, a list of what was deemed as positives or negatives. And I mean, that is a phenomenal level of detail to go to for any manager, but shows you he was taking an interest in who he was talking to. And I think, like his players, he knew that there were different ways of making people tick. So he was almost orchestrating the media a little bit. But at the same time, he was giving you so much content. I would walk away from the training ground with a notepad absolutely full of stories, ideas, quotes, theories. And it was quite exceptional, really.
Yeah, and I mean, because I joined in the December of 2016, so Newcastle won the championship, and Benitez was obviously in charge and had the privilege of going to a few press conferences, and he just had you in the kind of the palm of his hand. You loved listening to him, you loved talking to him. And what I find funny on reflection, Lee, I don't know if you agree, is that on the record, he never really said anything of much substance. It was interesting, but it wasn't headline grabbing. And yet, you look at the viewing figures for managers down the years in terms of what does well on our website. I'm not going to give any secrets away here, but Benitez was always so popular and popular and popular. But yet, when you actually read what he said, I look back and think it really wasn't all that exciting, but there was just something about him that I guess us as journalists loved working with him and listening to him, but also the fans loved reading.
Well, he had that aura about him. He remains an elite manager, really, and he will be in another job sooner rather than later. If you look at that, the UEFA conference every year, they have the managers, all the top managers go, and then they all line up and get their picture taken, and he's on it with Pep Guardiola. And you know, that says it all for me, that he is an elite manager, and every young manager will thrive to try and be like him. And the supporters, as you say, they were hanging on every word he was saying. And they were, look, if you remember, I was looking back at something the other day that I was writing, and Newcastle were rock bottom of the league in early November in his last season. He hadn't won a game, and the fans were still chanting his name. Any other manager wouldn't be able to survive that. And I think I wrote at the time saying that there's very few managers that are above criticism, but maybe he is one that was, because I just knew inside that he was going to turn it around for Newcastle that season. And that's exactly what he did. And then obviously the political meltdown came. He didn't get a contract, or he did get offered a contract, but it wasn't a very good one. And he ended up obviously, sadly, leaving the football club. And, you know, we moved on to another controversial chapter.
Yeah, we did. But just sitting with Benitez just ever so briefly, there was the moments abroad, wasn't there? You've been writing for our website and for the paper, this Managing Newcastle series, where you've gone into detail about kind of what we're doing now, talking about the managers who've been in charge during your time. And there is that incident with Benitez, isn't there, where there's yourself and a couple of other journalists. Is it over in Portugal? And I can't remember what exactly type of the, I mean, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. I'll let you take the story from here, but it's a really interesting reflection.
Yeah, that was, that picture's, I wouldn't say it's famous. Don't hang in it. We won't be hanging it in a museum, but at the end of the day, that picture, you know, on local circles, you know, there's three journalists in there who made the trip over to Portugal. It was actually in Braga. This beautiful stadium in Braga, which behind one of the goals is a rock face, and it's just an breathtaking ground to go to. But Newcastle got absolutely hammered there, 4-0 in the pre-season friendly against Braga. And we knew something was kind of brewing behind the scenes, because we'd spoken to Rafa the day before. We were all working at the team hotel because we've been doing sort of player interviews and things like that. And we're all working away in the corner of the hotel reception. And Rafa comes over and basically starts holding court in this impromptu manner. No one was expecting it. And he basically said, you know, what are the morning headlines tomorrow then, boys, sort of thing. And then having this chat, and then he just starts in, that's not true, that's not true, I wouldn't be writing that. And just give a dream for a journalist, because you're getting a full guidance of what's going on. And the next day, obviously, they got beat 4-0. And then on camera, he put on this performance, which it was genuine performance because he needed to do it. It was a political sort of stance on where Newcastle were. And he just said, there's loads of problems behind the scenes. I'm not sure if we're going to have money to spend. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to sign this player. And none of the players are going to talk to you tonight because there's a political dispute over the bonuses. And it obviously just exploded. And that was a huge back page headlines to go back home. And it got the desired effect for him, because obviously he got to sign some players, but I don't think he got everything he wanted. And yeah, referencing that start of the season where they didn't win until November, you know, that says it all, that his fears were justified.
It reaffirms his knowledge of how to use the press as well, because it wasn't the only time he did something like that. I remember after, was it a draw with Fulham? And he said afterwards, if this team stays up, it'll be a miracle. And you kind of felt he didn't mean it in terms of the, you know, he didn't mean to offend the players, but he was sending a message out to Mike Ashley more than anything else. But it was a bold move to do something like that, because as much as you might not mean to offend the players, there's nothing to guarantee they don't read that quote and say, all right, Gaffer, so you're saying we're not good enough. And that was what he was trying to do. He's trying to get his message out to the media via, you know, us and other outlets to warn Mike Ashley, essentially, we need additions here. And that was what Benitez did. There was often something bubbling away, wasn't there, under the surface?
Yeah, at the end of the day, I thought that was a genius bit of management, really, because not only did it create these explosive headlines, but it also, it did motivate the players. It did shake them up a bit, and they probably needed it at the time because, you know, they were struggling a bit. And it just makes players, you know, turn around and just go, look, I'll show you I'm not a bad player. And it just gets that, you know, sometimes that extra 5-10% from a player that you weren't expecting. And yeah, I mean, look, he obviously wasn't a bad choice of player. I mean, look at somebody like Hosolu, who we had at Newcastle, didn't have the greatest of times here, but he's gone to La Liga playing for Real Madrid, scoring goals. So he obviously knew something about that particular player. And I think it was the same with a lot of the players that he had on board. Most of his signings were a big success, and you know, they went on to you know, achieve little things for the club, obviously getting promoted from the Championship and then staying in the division. I think they finished 10th one season, which was remarkable. So lots of memories about Rafa. But yeah, I mean, I think it says it all that, you know, I wrote that piece last week and a lot of comments were positive about his time in charge at the club.
Yeah, still held in very high regard by the fans. Someone else that is thought of very fondly, Chris Hughton, obviously guided Newcastle to promotion in the Championship to the Premier League. What's your call of his time in charge?
Yeah, so for me, the big thing that I remember about Chris Hughton is that the situation we've spoke about already on this podcast, which was about Alan Pardew almost losing the press room and people being banned and not answering questions, that was sort of building a little bit under Chris Hughton. He was aware of, it was sparked by the Marlon Harewood player rating, which we spoke about on this podcast as well. And he got such a low rating that it caused a revolt in the dressing room that some players said we're not speaking to the local paper anymore because of this. And basically Chris Hughton said, right, we'll have a meeting. And we went down the training ground. Very, very civil, cup of tea over the table at the training ground. And Chris Hughton just said, look, I don't want to go to war with the local press or any journalists. He said, we all want the same thing. We want to see Newcastle win. And, you know, I'll smooth it over with the players, leave that with me. I'll still speak to you. I'll give you everything you need. But at the end of the day, we're trying to create a positive environment. And, you know, the performance wasn't good at Nottingham Forest, but we have to move on. I mean, they got beat 2-1 off Scunthorpe in the next game. But after that, everything was great again. And, you know, he obviously went on to win the league. And, you know, another great guy and someone who, you know, I've kept in touch with. And again, you know, has offered some, you know, good sort of advice, not just about football, on life at times. So, yeah, great to have such a good manager and good coach, good person at the football club at that time.
I couldn't have summed it up better then. We'll just briefly talk about some of the names we haven't spoken about. I mean, we start with Shearer briefly in charge in the season Newcastle first went down to the Championship. What was that like, him coming in and trying to save Newcastle's season?
Very brave. At the time, I looked at it, you know, probably a bit differently to I would now. I looked at it as this is Alan Shearer's big chance. Like Kevin Keegan came in 1992, and you know, I likened it to that at that time. I think the team was pretty much already relegated by that time. It was so flat. I think they got beat 1-0 at Bolton Wanderers in one of the games, and it was one of the worst performances I've seen by a Newcastle team, and very brave for Alan Shearer to come in. You see managers now, I mean, Rafa came in with 10 games to go and saved Newcastle. Not actually didn't save Newcastle, sorry. You know, took Newcastle down with 10 games to go. Alan Shearer was right up against it with 8 games to go. It was pretty much a done deal. But fair play, he was brave. He had a go. He tried to change things. He tried to change the culture at the club. Some of the players weren't accepting that. You know, there's some famous incidents from those 8 games. But what I do remember is, you know, after Newcastle relegated, speaking with Alan Shearer about some of his plans moving forward, how he was going to tackle the Championship, the ideas that he had, and, you know, the players he was going to sign, they were all quite, you know, impressive. And it was all ready to go, all ready to be signed off. And he would have been manager in the Championship. And I genuinely think, give him a pre-season, give him a couple of windows to work with it, I think he would have got Newcastle promoted. And then history could have been totally different. But Alan Shearer's now become probably the most famous pundit in the world. And football history's changed.
Still waiting for that call off Mike Ashley as well for the job, which he'll never get now. Kevin Keegan returning to the club under Mike Ashley. I mean, those scenes will live long in the memory for anyone that remembers. I mean, first of all, you had that the game against Stoke where he was in the crowd, and then it was announced he was coming back, and Sam Allardyce kind of, I mean, I felt sorry for Sam in many ways because the writing was on the wall, and yet he still had to go out and perform. But Keegan coming back must have been, I guess, a little bit surreal, Lee, in many ways, because you know, you grew up supporting Newcastle United during the Entertainers era, which was obviously so exciting. Keegan nearly leading Newcastle to the title, and then him coming back and your job being the man to ask him the questions, it must have been, yeah, a little bit surreal.
Yeah, I mean, it was a whirlwind when he came back. Again, I'm probably sitting here now a bit longer in the tooth, and I would probably look at that situation a little bit differently now if that was the case, because Kevin Keegan hadn't worked in football for quite a long time, and he'd walked away from a couple of other jobs. He initially walked away from Newcastle. Don't get me wrong, the Kevin Keegan era, the first time around, is something that I still cherish now. Watch the videos, the DVDs, the memory matches. I've still got all the programs, all the merchandise, and I look back on it and I treasure it, and I feel privileged that I was part of, you know, that era as a supporter. But second time around, as much as we all wanted it to work, it, you know, it's the old thing in romance. You should never go back. And sadly, it was pretty obvious quite early on that it wasn't going to work. And he was a different character. I think some of the former players have said, we remember him the first time at Newcastle, and he was full of life and full of energy. The second time, Mike Ashley quickly drained all of that out of him, and he was a different manager. And I remember being on pre-season in Mallorca, and, you know, again, you get that bit of time with the manager, and, you know, he turned around and just, you know, we were putting all these names to him and the signings and stuff like that, and he just went, nah, he says, these are different days now, and just shook his head and said, sorry, guys, you know, we're not in that era anymore. And no surprise, a few months later or a few weeks later, he was gone.
Yeah, I remember that game against Hull, and it'll always stay with me because the scenes, it was like a city tearing itself apart. It was so bizarre. You remember fans arguing with each other in the terraces, because some were supporting, some were singing, some were grumbling, protests outside. And that was obviously because Keegan had walked and things were very chaotic. And who was the striker that Zisco scored, yeah. Didn't he? His only goal for Newcastle in that game. 2-1 defeat, I think it was. But yeah, the scenes off the pitch that day was something that I don't think, thankfully, we will ever see again, but something that will definitely stay with me just in terms of defining how bad it really got. I suppose that we said we weren't going to talk about every manager, but we've spoken about most of them, so we're going to have to give the two or three we haven't mentioned a quick word. We'll start with John Carver, who came in briefly but kept Newcastle up. Jonas Gutierrez scoring against West Ham after returning from his cancer battle, which was kind of the Hollywood ending, really. But John Carver, I think people remember him, Lee, for being very confident in his abilities. What do you remember of him in charge of Newcastle?
Well, again, I think another person who took on a job in a brave way. And, you know, for me, I think you've got to remember the facts with John Carver. He came in, he took the job. He'd done it because he loved the club. He'd done it, you know, after Alan Pardew had walked away. He was instantly told there was no money to spend, and he was told he was going to have to sell, not just no money to spend, but he was going to have to sell David Santon, Younger and Beer, the two sales taken away from straight away. And I think then he had Papi Cisse returned from the African Nations injured. Cheick Tioti also returned injured. So he was quickly depleted. And I think either side, there was a patch of games where Newcastle lost them all. But either side of that patch of games, I think he rallied reasonably well, started getting some decent performances from people like Remy Cabella, if you remember. And I think at one point, I think Mike Ashley was ready, obviously, before the losing run. I think at one point, Mike Ashley was going to give him the job on a full-time basis. But sadly, for him, it didn't work. He moved on, doing a great job now with Scotland. Assistant manager, he's helped lead them to two tournaments, two Euros, which is unthinkable. Scotland getting to major tournaments compared to what's happened in the past. I think he's done other jobs in Cyprus as well. So, you know, I just think John Carver's just someone who loves the club and, you know, still attends games. You know, I think he had a real tear in his eye when the Champions League music was on against PSG. And, you know, I think he gave it everything he could. I think he often gets unfair criticism for the best coach in the world statement. But I think away from the cameras, you know, that's just one snapshot. Away from the cameras, I think most people in that room knew what he meant. He meant that if you're not confident in life, you ain't going to get anywhere. And he was just using himself as a comparison, saying if he didn't go on the coaching field and wasn't confident, then he would he wouldn't have a chance. So I think his time there was turbulent, but he'd done the job. He kept Newcastle up. He did what some bigger names didn't do, couldn't do. And I think as well, what Rose got documented is that he didn't get the sack because he got asked to remain at Newcastle after that. And it was his decision to go because he didn't feel that it was a fair thing to do to work with Steve McLaren. And he wanted to move on. But as I've done in a couple of articles since, I think he's been offered a couple of chances to go back and work with the academy in different roles. So, yeah, someone who's dedicated his whole life pretty much to Newcastle United. So, yeah.
Yeah, great character. And just finally, you mentioned him there, but Steve McLaren, well, you know, it didn't go well at all. And the whole lead up to his appointment was bizarre as well. You know, they wanted him. He didn't want to leave his contract with Derby. Then it happened, and it just utterly bizarre. But in terms of dealing with them, Lee, on a week-by-week basis, what was it like?
Well, I believe it or not, I'd actually dealt with him before because I'd covered Middlesbrough before. And when I covered Middlesbrough, it was probably the best 2 years of the club's history because they won a trophy. They won the... what was it called back then? Worthington Cup was League Cup. Won that and got into Europe for the first time. And then, you know, a couple of years later, got to a UEFA Cup final. So I knew Steve McLaren was a very good coach. He worked with some of the very best in Sir Alex Ferguson. He'd been the England manager. That hadn't worked. That, you know, some bad decisions there. So I knew that he understood the media and had no problems in terms of communicating with him. You know, again, somebody away from the cameras who comes across completely different to, you know, when he's in front of a packed press conference, someone who's a lot calmer. And I think you get the measure of the man when the cameras aren't there. Some managers can deal well with the cameras. Some not so well. And a lot of people say about Steve McLaren, he's one of the best assistant managers or the best coaches you could have. But fair play to him. He won things with Middlesbrough, won things with FC 20. I really hoped he could do it again for Newcastle, like I do with all managers. But sadly, I think, as I wrote in a recent article about his time there, he underestimated how deep-rooted the problems were at Newcastle. And you know, he wanted to do the job so much that he perhaps didn't do his due diligence or didn't have time to do it. The signings that he sort of unveiled at the start of that season were pretty much already done. He barely had any senior centre-backs. He inherited the bare bones of a squad that John Carver had. We talk about John Carver there. And he had a threadbare squad, didn't have any money to spend. And then Steve McLaren went in and had two or three signings. Wijnaldum was a big signing at the time. But unfortunately, it didn't fall into place for him. And it ended badly.
It certainly did. I always remember the game against Bournemouth and Eddie Howe in charge. And they absolutely thumped Newcastle United, didn't they? And just finally, Sam Allardyce. Now, he came in under Freddie Shepherd. He'd done wonders at Bolton, leading them to Europe, if I'm not mistaken. He'd come in. Newcastle had signed a few players in that summer. Martins was one of them. They actually beat Bolton on the opening day of the season 3-1. And things started pretty well. But then Mike Ashley comes in, buys up the club, and obviously his future at the club's quickly over. But before Ashley came in, Lee, did you think Allardyce could be a success at the club?
Yeah, I did. Basically off the back of what he achieved with Bolton Wanderers. And, you know, he led them up from the Championship. He played a certain way. There was a lot of sports science involved. which he brought with him to Newcastle. Brought an army of staff with him. But he said that, you know, if you're paying millions of pounds for footballers, it's worth paying a little bit extra to get staff in who are going to be able to help get the best out of them. I think he got off to a great start. It was one of the best starts in the Premier League. They were right up there in a European spot, but then it started to unravel. And the fact that Mike Ashley had taken over, it wasn't Mike Ashley's man. He signed some good players, Mark Viduka being one of them. You know, that was the potential of having Mark Viduka, Ober Martins and Michael Owen as a front three was very exciting at the time. And he did see some progress that he was making, but in the end, I think he kind of had that tag of being a long ball manager. And when it didn't work out, I think people were already armed with that criticism to put to him. Mike Ashley was sitting on the terraces with the supporters. They were calling for change. And it was inevitable that, you know, there was going to be a big change. Ironically, Mike Ashley wanted a manager who just wanted, he was an owner who just wanted to stabilise Newcastle. He wanted the mid-table, staying above the relegation zone, getting a 40 points every season. And Sam Allardyce has made a career of doing that. And he got rid of him. So it was a really strange affair. But as a bloke, you know, I've spoken to him since, haven't got as close a sort of friendship with him as I did with other managers. But, you know, spoke to him since, decent guy. And sadly, you know, his England tenure only lasted one game. That would have been interesting if he'd had a bit longer in that hot seat. So, you know, he's the type of sort of person who would tell you how it is at a press conference. And if he was unhappy with something, he'd let you know. And you're not really going to argue with Sam Allardyce. So, a lot of memories. Probably so many we kind of fit them all on this podcast.
Yeah, no, indeed, especially with the list that we've got. The final question then, Lee, is if you were running a dinner party, so me and John Gibson, we did an episode last week where we picked our ultimate Newcastle United dinner party guest list that included Alan Shearer and a few Newcastle United legends. So not everyone on this list is going to be included in the bracket of Newcastle United legend, but I'm going to ask you from this list that we've got here, if you could have three people round the table for dinner from the list, who would you have?
I mean, there's so many to choose from, but you know, Rafa Benitez would be on that list because he could hold court and have a conversation with you. Because Alan Shearer is Alan Shearer, and he's got such a great sense of humour and so many great stories to tell. You would have him around the table also, and you couldn't not invite Eddie Howe, could you, given what he's achieved in the last few years. And I think the dynamic of those three football brains around the table, I think that would be make for a fascinating evening.
It certainly would too. Well, this has been the latest episode of In Conversation with Lee Wright. I hope you guys have enjoyed it. Hit thumbs up if you're watching on YouTube. Hit subscribe if you're on the podcast channel. Thank you as always. Leave us a rating and review. And for myself and Lee, we'll see you guys next week.